you know, it became kind of the inspiration for the record. And when my wife got pregnant, I just started writing lyrics. And I wrote all the lyrics before touching a guitar, which was not the approach that I would normally take. It's just like, you know, I had to get it out. And it was kind of just chewing me up inside. So it was this really cathartic thing for me.
Brian, hey, how's it going?
Good to see you, Andy. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no, it's so great to be able to catch up with you. I mean, shit, dude, I haven't seen you in real life. And I mean, well, obviously over the last year or so with the whole pandemic, but I think prior to that, I'm trying to recall when it was that I saw you at the last.
Like at a show a couple years ago, I'd say something like that.
It must've been like a Great Apes show, you know? Like, I mean, cause Great Apes has been done for how long now?
I don't know. Everything is so blurry and foggy right now, but I'd say I think it was 2 years this past summer. Like we did our last shows 2 years ago as of August.
Okay. Cause I want to say that I was at your last show because it was at Bottom of the Hill, right?
Right. That's correct. And yeah, thinking back now using my child's birth as a gauge, that's correct. Yeah. It was two years ago, August. Yeah, there's the Bottom of the Hill one. And then we did a couple down in Southern California.
Okay. Yeah. Because yeah, like I don't think that I'd really caught you since then, but you know, when I do get to see you, it's always a great opportunity because shit, you know, we go back quite a bit.
Decades, homie, decades.
Yeah. Like seriously, at least more than one decade. Cause I want to say that I met you. I think the first time I ever met you in person was at the Borderline Warehouse in Sonora.
Yes.
When, you know, your old band Alien Spy played a couple shows up there. And I think that my old band played a few shows with you up there too.
Yeah, totally. That's how we met. I'm sure that's how we met.
Right. And I know that over the years we played a handful of shows in the various bands that I was in, like, you know, I know that Blast Bandits came down and played a few shows with you guys in the Bay Area. And then, yeah, I mean, our history is pretty entangled. Like, you know, we've done some work together with Sell the Heart Records, with Great Apes. And, you know, I've always been a huge advocate for the bands that you've been in, you know, Great Apes. And I mean, shoot, let's go down the list. So you have Hanale, which is, you know, who we're going to be talking about a lot on this podcast, which is your solo project. You have Great Apes, which is your like kind of more punk rock band that, you know, recently put out a few records through like Asian Man Records and whatnot. And then you had Ole Ole, right? And that was when you were out in Chicago, right?
No, that was the band. We started that band right when I moved back from Chicago. So
oh, okay.
A bunch of really old friends were involved in that, yeah.
Okay, but so Ole Ole, mm-hmm. And you were also in The Ghost, and that was when you were in Chicago, right?
Correct, yeah. Okay. Formed in the Bay, and then we moved out there as a band.
Okay, got it. So, and then prior to that, I know you were in the Wonder Years, which was Tomato Head Records, right?
Correct, yeah. And then I'm trying to remember, did Josh's label, I feel like, well, Side With Us, Leslie's label re-released.
That's right.
The last EP, and I'm trying to remember, I was like, I guess Tomato Head put that last one out. I was trying to remember for a second if Josh and Sarah's label Flying Herald was involved, but I don't think they were.
Okay.
This is how old I am. I can't even remember like who put records I played on out.
Right.
Yeah.
And let's see. And then, so you had Wonder Years. And then prior to that, as far as I know, you were in that band Alien Spy. And then I'm not sure if I know of any other projects that you were in.
You're now into the embarrassment realm of high school bands I was in. Yeah, there's that one. I was in a little side project with a couple friends. Do you get to call it a side project when you're in fucking high school? It was a band that not as much time was spent on it, but we were really trying to emulate Schlong, which still to this day, I actually still really enjoy a handful of Schlong records. Mm-hmm. I worked at a venue for a while in Chicago, and when it was my duty to clear the room, I'd just put on a Schlong record and it always worked. So.
Yeah. Schlong's one of those like special bands that I think people who know about them just like cannot get enough of it. But then like nobody else knows what you're talking about at all, you know? But within like the greater Bay Area scene, I mean, shit, I mean, like you guys, you got members of Operation Ivy in that band. So, I mean,
and Jew Driver too, which is, you know, that stuff's pretty great as well.
Oh man. Oh, well, you know, speaking of bands that start with J, and other projects that you've been in.
So, oh yes, there's that one.
Yeah. So there is Jawbreaker, the infamous Jawbreaker that you've done, which if anyone does not know what I'm talking about. So, I mean, it's not the Jawbreaker, like the shirt, but Jaw, like, you know, Rastafari, you know, Jawbreaker. And, you know, I know that you've talked about this a little bit, how it's kind of interesting how your joke bands have kind of done better than your more serious bands. I mean, anything you'd like to kind of mention about that while I've got you here?
I mean, so first of all, that little deal was, we came up with it in the van on a Great Apes jaunt somewhere. And, you know, then proceeded to drunkenly discuss it a couple other times. And then at one point we're just like, fuck it, let's do this for Halloween. And it was meant to offend, right? Because I think in certain circles, Jawbreaker is on like Christ or pedestal status, where that's the band you don't fuck with, you don't make fun of them, you never criticize them. And punks can be very sensitive creatures. And so the idea was like, let's just do the worst thing possible. Like, what's the worst, you know, thing you can imagine doing to Jawbreaker? It's like, oh, play it as awful white boy reggae. And sure enough, it offended a lot of people, and others thought it was hilarious. And yeah, it was like, we played one show, a house party on Halloween, that was it, released 7-inch, and yeah, certainly got more attention than anything that I've you know, actually put serious emotion, blood, sweat, and tears into, but you know, such is life.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be such an interesting like thing to have to wrap your head around, you know, as an artist, because I mean, you know, you are a pretty prolific songwriter and artist, and like you've been involved in all these bands that have had a lot of like, you know, accolades like thrown on you. Like, I know that people speak very highly of your work with like the Ghost and the Wonder Years and Hanalei and Great Apes. You know, I mean, I don't know of many accolades from like the Alien Spies days, but
oh, they're if they're there, they certainly should not be.
Oh boy.
No offense to anyone that I played with. You all are great, but yeah. So yeah, that's weird, but.
Yeah. Well, and I can't help but say too that I know that on social media, there've been these moments where I've caught these threads that you go on where, you know, you'll start kind of naming off these potential joke name bands, and some of them just go on for days, and some of them are like extremely clever, and I'm actually surprised that some people don't do them. But like, are there any others of note that you kind of wish you would do?
Yeah, there. But I think like the risk factor with this one, Andy, is so much higher. But one that I came up with was Stock Spar, which is all white collar, like trading themed Cox Bar songs. Awesome. Just about just being a fucking capitalist pig, basically. You know, it's like Cox Bar meets Wolf of Wall Street, basically. And I will say to give credit where credit's due, loosely inspired by the band Hugh Corrupts. From Chicago. They're a great hardcore band. But I think the consequences with that one would be pretty severe. And I'm working on a little project with a buddy called Yelp the Band right now.
Yes.
And that is basically, it's, you know, 80s inspired punk and hardcore. And all the lyrics are verbatim one-star Yelp reviews. Every song is named after the business and the location. So we have like Jamba Juice of the Oakland International Airport, so forth and so on. But yeah, I don't. Sometimes I just wish that I could just focus on being funny, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, no, I personally, I think it's brilliant. Like, I'm a fan of that kind of stuff because it is like tongue in cheek, and it is very kind of quote unquote punk rock because it's not taking itself very seriously. It's fun. It's meant to be a little like a little bit offensive, you know, but at the same time, humorous and lighthearted and like whatever, you can make whatever you want with it. But now that we've covered all of your previous work, let's talk about this new album that you've got coming out with your solo project, Hanalei. Now you've been doing this project kind of off and on for the better part of about a decade.
Two decades. Oh, like, okay. Yeah, yeah, it's, You know, and this, it just, when I was doing the Ghost, I kind of wanted, as every, or a lot of, I don't know, naive and cocky early 20 something males do in punk rock, they, you know, you think you can write a solo record and you really can't. But I, you know, I had the traction, I guess, where I could get a record put out. Part of me wishes that didn't happen, but you know, as time went on, I think I got better at it. It kind of forced my hand, so to speak. But yeah, like 20 years I've been doing it. It's been sparse and occasional. It's kind of, and certainly this instance is no exception, when I don't have other shit going on, I'll kind of explore, but it's been 10 years since I put out a full length. You know, obviously there were a couple 7 inches you had a hand in one of those, and you know, a few singles that I released digitally, but yeah, the last full length came out 10 years ago. And I think that with Great Apes disbanding, that was a huge factor, because I didn't really have an outlet that was actively playing out or writing you know, that frequently. I was in a band called Sub Dio there for a minute, but it was a slow process, so it was kind of gave me you know, something to really like focus on creatively on my own. And then obviously, you know, with home recording technology where it's at, it's as seasoned musicians, it's nice to just have a studio option free of time constraints or financial constraints. Albeit it doesn't, you know, sound as good as it would have if I'd recorded with professionals, but right. Yeah, so it was really, you know, Great Apes kind of disbanded. You know, there's definitely no bad blood there. It was just people leaving San Francisco. And I dove into that. You know, the background on the record is, so I think, so my wife got pregnant. We have a kid now. He's about to be 2 in a couple months. And, you know, leading up to that, and this had gone on for a long time, I had very mixed emotions about having a child. You know, I've wanted to be a dad. However, I think that both environmentally, socially, politically, there's just, it's hard not to see the evil in the world, and question even where the world's going to be in 20 or 30, 40, 50 years. And that really kind of held me back at certain points, or created a conflict at least. And, you know, specifically as someone that grew up really appreciating nature, you know, my dad was a complete outdoorsman. He was a climber, skier, hiker. He's really old now and still is a search and rescue volunteer. And so having grown up, you know, in the Bay Area, nature up in the Sierras all the time, I spent a lot of time on the North Shore of Kauai as a kid, and just kind of seeing just crowds, pollution, and then, you know, just the scientific reality of what's happening to our climate and what projections we're looking at, that really terrified me, not being able to share that with my child, but then even more so, the thought of a child not having that as an option, or not, you know, later in their life, or not being able to share it with their child. It's like, it's anyone. It doesn't even matter that it's my child specifically, but that, you know, it became kind of the inspiration for the record. And when my wife got pregnant, I just started writing lyrics. And I wrote all the lyrics before touching a guitar, which was not the approach that I would normally take. It just, like, you know, I had to get it out. It was kind of just chewing me up inside. So it was this really cathartic thing for me, at least at the writing portion of it. So yeah, that's, you know, I spent so long on the record. Shit, between writing the lyrics, writing all the songs, and then recording it, over a year. And then, you know how it is with vinyl these days, like we're looking at basically another year since the thing was mastered. But wow. I've never worked so hard on a record. It doesn't sound like that if you're familiar with my catalog, because I recorded it myself. But I mean, it was gratifying and enjoyable, and definitely a huge learning experience for me. Jack Shirley recorded the drums on it. My friend Jerry, you know, played drums. That's the one thing I certainly cannot fuck with. Right. So, you know, that was great. The drums sound better than anything else. And Jack was also really instrumental in kind of guiding me through the process. I've self-recorded a lot before, but I feel like my game was upped, you know, with credit due to him. He was just really, really helpful and willing to kind of text me or have a quick chat at any point. So yeah.
Yeah. That's a great like thing to have at your disposal. And like, you know, Jack is really great. Like I had him on the show not that long ago.
Yeah. That was a couple weeks ago, right? Or since, yeah, it'll be different whenever you air this, but yeah.
Yeah. I want to say it was like 3 or 4 episodes ago. I mean, it's yeah. Like my brain's a blur right now too, but no, Jack's a great asset to have like on your team, like for any kind of recording project. He mixed the last Tsunami Bomb record, which was really great. And I know that he's done stuff for Great Apes and like Build Us Airplanes and stuff. So bands that I'm definitely associated with to a degree. So I think that that's awesome. Now you also have several other people that contributed to the record in small ways. Like I know you mentioned Josh Staples did some vocals, correct?
Yeah, Josh sang on, I'm trying to think of one song, Marshall from Great Apes sang on that same one. And then my friend Keely did some backups on a slower song. She kind of works more in the folk genre, has some like Nashville stuff going on. And she's one of those just pitch perfect people. It's insane. And that was, you know, I'm so grateful that she contributed. And then I had just a crew of friends one night in Sacramento put down some kind of gang vocals. Right after that, my computer started dying. It was like, you know, when you're self-recording, the record was getting close to done. The fans started going crazy. It was freezing. Then my kid knocked a jar of Papalote salsa into it. But yeah, luckily I was able to do some resuscitation and yeah. Everything lived.
Hey, that's great. Out of curiosity, what program were you using for recording?
I use Ableton, and it's not necessarily that I'm a loyalist. It's that I learned it a really long time ago from a friend in Chicago. And I was considering, I didn't want to buy a Pro Tools setup. I didn't have the money, but I was kind of considering going into Logic. I have the full version or the pro version of it. But then it's just when writing a whole record, and I wrote it as I recorded, and I think that that's a lot to do in conjunction with learning a whole new DAW. So I opted to stick with what I knew on this one.
Yeah. I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as the old saying goes.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I apparently Ableton's primarily used more so for DJing, EDM writing, but I find it very like user friendly and diverse as just your standard kind of like live music recording platform.
Nice. Yeah. I recently got Logic for my computer, so I'm going to be diving into that. I mean, I know that it's pretty similar to GarageBand, which is what I'm mostly familiar with, because I don't really have the money to pay for Pro Tools either. So that's fine with me. But no, I mean, that's great that you can kind of build up your recording chops too, because, you know, I'm sure that this is going to be something that you're going to continue to do, you know, as time moves on. So the more you can learn, the better. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so the album is called Black Snow. And I know that you touched on a little bit about like some of the inspiration for the songs themselves. I know that a few of the records that you've done in the past with the various projects have kind of had like these interesting themes to them. Like there was that Great Apes record where you took like the perspective of the different areas in San Francisco. And I thought that was freaking awesome. Like I love when people do that kind of thematic approach to the vocal. Were there any sources of inspiration besides like the state of the world that you kind of leveraged using or going into this album?
That's a great question. So yeah, I mean, first of all, going back to Great Apes, there was a point when we had recorded a few 7-inches before putting out the first full length. And I had just hit a wall in terms of writing from a first person perspective about my own shit, like me as the speaker. I'd done it for years and I'd been involved in so many bands, and I was kind of sick of whining or touching on the same subjects. I'd basically covered a lot of what I wanted to say. And I felt like it was more of a challenge for me as a writer and more important to kind of try to bring in other perspectives. So I haven't written a record that's not conceptual and narrated from other perspectives since the last Great Apes 7-inch before Thread came out. So yeah, this one, you know, having kind of given you some background on the inspiration for it, what it is it's kind of a collage of, you know, attainable or reachable fiction set in the near future in following basically a climate collapse and then in turn a societal collapse. So, you know, you have songs that are, there's one that's narrated from the perspective of the last standing bristlecone pine and it's about to burn down. You have one from the perspective of a child in basically post-apocalyptic Philadelphia. You know, there's one from the kind of climate denying sense that I'd say is back more so in kind of our frame of time, more contemporary, that basically, you know, I don't think that anyone that denies climate change, unless they're just a complete, like if they're on some complete religious nut shit, maybe, but anyone that's not on that kick, I don't think they truly believe it doesn't exist. I think that the motive there is just to keep their profits coming in and hey, their chances are they're older or middle-aged and fuck it. They're not going to be around when the ship sinks. So what do they care? So there's one song that is kind of narrated from that perspective, which is it's interesting to write and try to capture that because obviously that is the exact antithesis of where I'm coming from, but it's fun and it's challenging. And it's like, you can, I don't know, at least I tried to do it in a really scathing manner where it's so obviously sarcastic. If you know me, at least, I guess like it'd be weird if you heard it and you're like, yeah, this guy's a fucking dick, whoever wrote this. Like, but yeah, and it you know, it goes on from there. So each song is basically told from a different character's perspective, much like that the Playland of the Beach Great Apes record that you mentioned. Very like similar approach. That's just been my deal for a while. I'd imagine at some point I should or will break out of that because I don't like doing the same thing for too long. But
sure. I mean, like I said, I'll go back to this again. Like I think it's really quite interesting and really cool actually to kind of take that approach because to your point about, you know, having to write so often from the first person's perspective and how that's just so overdone. And it's like, that's kind of like the go-to for everyone is, you know, I mean, I don't want to put that as a blanket statement for everyone, but I was gonna make a quick joke. I was like, so essentially you're writing like a prog rock record, right? Basically, but no, I'm just kidding. But no, I think that's a really interesting approach to take. And I think I'd say you've done it really well. I mean, I like your lyrics quite a bit. And I think that you have a knack at doing this type of songwriting. So I'd say keep it up. But I wanted to touch on something that you mentioned. So knowing you for as long as I have, I know that you've never really shied away from kind of, you know, voicing your strong opinions about some things. And, you know, I think that that's great in so many ways. Do you feel like that's ever like kind of gotten you into like a bad position though, like within like the music scene? Like,
yeah, I mean, absolutely. Without a doubt. You know, I'll talk shit if I think it's warranted. You know, the same applies to praise, but I don't hold back and I don't think that I or anyone else, you know, should. I guess it's just a matter of personal preference. Yeah, I mean, there's specific instances don't really stand out, Andy, but certainly there's been backlash. And I think that, you know, punk is rife with contradiction. And as much as we want to think it's this very, very like progressive and inclusive space, it often isn't. And I think that, you know, that alone deserves criticism. And that piece of it has certainly got me in some hot water. But yeah, I mean, that's like throughout my time, my decades playing music, I you're absolutely correct. I don't think I've held back. I think at certain times I've said dumb shit that, you know, probably should have been a little more refined or withheld. You know, I sometimes I just kind of shoot from the hip without thinking first. And as I've gotten older, I've toned that down quite a bit. But yeah, I don't withhold. And, you know, music to me is never, it's never been in income, and I'm kind of grateful for that. So I think with that, knowing that it's something that I'm relying on because I need it to keep my head on straight, and because I feel like it is an immensely powerful vehicle to communicate ideas, to express emotion. You know, keeping it on that level for me is, has enabled me to be, I don't want to say protective, but knowing that there aren't, you know, well-being in terms of my job, there aren't consequences on that. Or like, what if this reviewer says this? What if this critic says this? Or if this agent fucking drops me or whatnot? It's like, knowing that that's not a factor has given me a little more freedom, perhaps.
Totally. Yeah, like I certainly, like personally, like I've never thought about anything that you've ever said either publicly or between us in private where I'm just like, dude, like that's stupid or like that's dumb. Like, as a matter of fact, like I'd say it's the contrary. I was like, no, you're right. Like something that I wanted to kind of expand on this was, you know, you just brought it up. Like the punk rock scene is not walking the walk, you know, nearly as much as I think that it thinks that it is, you know? And like, I think that you've been very vocal about that. And that's a good thing, you know, because more people need to be talking about it and bringing it up and holding others to like the fire and just being like, hey, no, like this is how it really is, you know, and maybe you should like consider this as like part of the problem, you know?
I think too, and thanks for saying that, Andy, and I agree with you. I think too, you know, we're about the same age. We grew up in similar communities. We saw similar things happen. I think that era with East Bay punk in particular involved a lot of fucking snobbery, a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of elitism. I think things have definitely changed now and in that particular region, but it you know, it stung as a kid. And it was, you know, again, when you think that you may have found this kind of utopian situation where you can be a real individual, and then, you know, you're basically upheld to an entirely different set of standards or another rule book. That's like that it hurts as a kid, especially as a kid. You know, now I don't fucking give a fuck. It's like whatever. It's all good. But I can tell you that, you know, when the Ghosts moved to Chicago, I was still very young. I was 21 years old, and the scene there was worlds apart and so much more inclusive, so much more diverse musically, culturally speaking. And that, I was just like, wow, man, this is how this shit's supposed to be. And I'd kind of gotten a taste of that there before on tour, which was part of the appeal of moving there. And it was cheap. We couldn't pay rent in the Bay Area and tour. So yeah, I mean, I think that's always, and this it's of course not just punk rock. There are so many subcultures where this same shit, you know, boils up. And yeah, and I, you know, that's certainly one of the things where it's a touchy subject some, but I would agree that, you know, if you're offended by that, then you're probably part of the fucking problem, you know? It's absolutely. And that applies to far more important issues going on right now in contemporary society, you know, so.
Right. If my hope is that if anything good comes out of this last year, and in that, like, we've been glued to our screens, we've been glued to the news, and we've come out of what has to have been like the craziest last 4 years of a presidency in our lifetime, if not like the last century, you know, because who knows what really happened like before, like 100 years ago, because who writes the history books and all that stuff.
He's certainly the shit stain on America's toilet bowl of history. Like,
it's like, he's not even worth talking about anymore at this point, but
yeah.
But my hope is that because so much has been talked about and brought up and it just keeps coming back up, that it'll force some change for good. And it already has to a degree. I mean, it's going to take a little while for us to, I think, really see the positives to kind of come to the surface and actually start affecting people in a legitimate way. Especially the people who most need the help, like the poor and, like, you know, people of color and trans people and, you know, all of these like groups of people that have been crying out for help for years, you know, for decades. And it's, I don't know, like something has to change. And, you know, people arguing over what's punk and what isn't is like so stupid.
Right. It's, yeah, I agree. And I have similar hopes. I think that, you know, the culmination of the past 4 years and this pandemic, it's, you know, maybe we'll see like a renaissance and people that, you know, actually deserve to be treated as first-class citizens for once, you know, might get a shot of that. I might, you know, my problem with the history of this country is that change is, it's the speed that it happens at is cruel. It's fucking, you know, as a teacher, like I incorporate a lot of social studies into my English class and you really get into it. And if you try to teach history from a lens that isn't the victors, it's just a fucking mess of repeating patterns of atrocity. It's like, it's awful. And it's frustrating and it's depressing. It, you know, it's hard sometimes. Like I've been accused of being a cynic and I try not to be, but it's hard sometimes not to, if you really start peeling away, I don't know, the bullshit on everything. It's just, yeah, I don't, now I'm getting bummed just talking about this, but that's, as I should be. It's, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly not the point of this podcast to like deep dive into like the problems of US, you know, economic policy, but.
I mean, I can, I don't mind, but it's your show.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's of course like worth talking about, but you know, for the purpose of the show, like we don't have to go down that rabbit hole too far, but.
Let's go back to the hope.
Go ahead.
Let's hope for, you know, a renaissance, an arts renaissance, and more importantly, justice and, you know, a push towards equality. There's been work obviously in progress that's been made, but we need to get further. And I am hopeful, Andy. So yeah.
I am too, you know, and I think that the younger generations are going to really like give us some stuff to think about, you know, because I think not only from the aspect that information is getting faster, cheaper, you know, to get, and people are so much more connected now than they ever have been. And it's only going to get even wilder in that respect. And I think things will become so much more, you know, global minded versus, you know, small town minded, like it had been. Cause you know, like you said, like when we were growing up, like I grew up in the Sierra Nevadas of Northern California, which is only like a 3-hour drive from where you grew up in Berkeley. Right. But they may as well have been different coasts, you know, because shit, like I didn't have MTV growing up when I was a little kid, you know, so I didn't have all that same culture that other people did. I mean, if you want to call it culture, but you know, at the same time, like once I kind of like finally caught up, like it felt like, okay, like now I'm caught up, you know, and it, for a while there, it actually felt like a detriment. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like it felt like I was missing out on something.
I mean, you were. Yeah, it's yeah.
I mean, my parents didn't think so. My parents were like, oh, you're not really missing out on anything. But I was just like, yeah, but you don't understand. Like, here I am, like 13, 14 years old. And that's what I want to know about, you know? Yeah.
So, you know, I'm up in that zone a lot. We basically, my wife and I went in with family and bought a little cabin in Long Barn, just above Sonora. My thinking was, hey, I can never, as a teacher, buy in the Bay. And obviously I've moved out of the Bay now. So I was like, fuck it. I love the mountains. Just do that and get up as much as possible. And honestly, while technology and communication has bridged that gap to a degree, those are still, as I'm sure you know, very much different worlds. Like, you know, being up there, we hid out there for the first couple months of the quarantine of the pandemic. And you know, like I'd go into the store before masks were required and I'd put a mask on. And I was, you know, this is kind of before like the surface thing had been debunked. And I was fucking terrified just even being in a store. But you just get like the giant good old boy who'd walk in and just kind of give you the fucking up and down and not directly say it, but the eyes are basically just looking at you and just being like, you fucking pussy. Yeah. And you're just like, you know what, man? Like, all right, you just keep doing you. Yep.
It can be very frustrating.
And by no means, not, there are so many rad people that live around there too, but you know, there's all kinds, and that's, you know, sometimes these place like San Francisco is liberally monochromatic and in terms of color too, literally. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to kind of bridge this conversation into something that you brought up earlier. So you have lived in Chicago for, like, you lived there for how long?
I was out there for 5 years.
Okay, 5 years. And
yeah,
so
maybe a little more.
Go ahead.
I said maybe a little more. I don't exactly remember, but it was something between 5 and 6.
Got it. And you actually brought up one of the questions I was going to bring up to you was, like, so having lived there, and then, you know, your time in the Bay Area, I mean, you touched on the fact that there was this major difference that you noticed in terms of, like, the inclusivity and, you know, the way that they kind of treated people within the music scene. Is there anything else, like, you'd want to kind of touch on that in terms of, like, what you saw and, like, maybe what drove that? Like, was there anything that you thought was, like, a major, like, factor in that? Because, you know, you'd think that with the Bay Area being so, like, diverse and, you know, multicultural, multifaceted, it's like a working class city in Oakland, but like a major, like, you know, kind of metropolitan in, you know, San Francisco, and then all the little suburb towns around. Like, I'm curious as to, like, why you think that would be the case.
So that's a super interesting question. I think there are a handful of factors, and I'm sure there are a lot more that I'll miss. Number one, I mean, that's a true metropolis, right? I'd say, like, Chicago and New York, like, those are real fucking cities, you know? Sure, you can add the Bay Area all together or even include LA in the conversation, but there's just the density and the size of it, really, I think that really factors in to the diversity of cultures and experiences you're getting and influences. Also, like, if we're going to talk about the music scene too, you know, at this point in the early 2000s, Chicago's really, I think, come up more so lately in conversations about, you know, being a cultural epicenter, an epicenter of the arts, and it's become more of a trendy place to live, much like Minneapolis. But, you know, at that point, it was often overlooked. Sure, bands are going through there all the fucking time, and there's a deep history of punk rock there amongst, like, so much good, like, R&B, soul, house music. But it wasn't like, you know, if we're talking punk, it wasn't like the fucking Bay Area or New York. So I think that people there are more appreciative and like, of music. And I really think that the, like, the blue collar factor plays in there too. There's immense amounts of wealth in certain neighborhoods or with certain people in Chicago, but as a whole, it's really like a working class city at its core. And I think that, you know, that played into that as well. But yeah, you know, I think getting my deal was, as soon as I moved out there, I picked up a couple shifts at Fireside Bowl. And I ended up working for Brian Peterson, basically, but he's the promoter, he's a great guy. I miss him still. And, you know, that led to just constant venue work. And that's all I did there. I ran a little publicity thing for indie labels for a while too, and did a little bit of writing on the side, but I just worked in venues. And that, I think, the exposure that comes along with that, you know, gave me a lot in terms of my musical tastes and meeting people I wouldn't have otherwise and thinking about things I maybe wouldn't have otherwise. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I mean, I don't know if this would really play too much of a factor of it, but I mean, Chicago, I guess, is an older city than San Francisco, and it's had more time to kind of be a city, you know. Like, and like you mentioned, like, I do think that you're right. I think that, you know, it being such a big metropolitan area that is very expansive and very much like people are on top of each other, you know. And San Francisco is very dense too, but it's small. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a fucking quaint Swedish village in comparison to Chicago.
Right. And in the most dense of areas in San Francisco, there's not really a lot of people that live there. It's most people that work there, you know. So, I think that you hit the nail on the head. And, you know, I wanted to mention, you know, there was something that I read a long time ago. And I think I want to say it was Spin Magazine, and it was an interview with Damon. I can't remember his last name, but the guy from Blur,
Albarn, I think.
I think it's Albarn, yeah. And the question got posed to him. He's like, "What do you think is one of the main differences between, like, music in, like, England and Europe versus music in America?" And he says that I'll never forget this. He's like, we've had hundreds and hundreds of more years to develop culture and irony. And I thought that was brilliant. I was like,
that's a great response.
Yeah. I thought that was so brilliant. And I mean, I haven't spent nearly enough time in any of those countries to necessarily call myself an expert at all, but I certainly appreciate the art and music that comes out of like the UK and Europe. And I kind of don't think he's wrong.
Like, right. And maybe they did American rock and roll better than Americans did.
I think there's a compelling argument for that. I mean, you know, like this kind of dives into like that whole, like who created punk rock, and like, you know, people say, well, oh, the Ramones versus the Clash or the Sex Pistols, like all that stuff. And I don't even want to go down that row with you, but it does kind of create like this big, like philosophical kind of ordeal where you're like, huh, I do wonder about that. And like, you know, like maybe like, it's not to say that like there isn't good art in America. Of course there is, you know, like there's great art here, but it does make you kind of wonder about like, even within America, how it changes from place to place. And like, the different scenes and like I don't want to quantify it with like a value, you know, but I do think that there is something to be said about that, you know.
Absolutely.
And the culture that gets brought into it,
you know? Yeah. And it's a huge country, and I should have touched on this too, but you know, that's, you bring up a really good point there. And I think that, you know, obviously different regions in the United States have their own culture, you know, that kind of comes out of all the diversity and all the different things that are coming in and becomes normalized. And, you know, if we were to go to the Deep South right now, obviously that's so drastically different than where we're at. Same with Alaska or the Northeast. And Chicago definitely has its own thing. And one of the things there that I immediately noticed before I moved there was kind of just like brutal honesty. And I don't even want to say brutal, just, it may seem harsh to a Californian, but people are just generally very upfront there. And they, what they say is what they mean, and people don't hold back. And to go back to what we discussed earlier about my refusal to hold back or my failure to hold back, that kind of worked and vibed with me, perhaps more so than the Bay Area did. You know, Californians sometimes don't like that because everything is you know, lightly touched upon and also just fake as fuck at others. Like someone in California is way more likely to smile and say hi and then talk an immense amount of shit behind your back than a Chicagoan's likely to do that. A Chicagoan will just walk right up to you and tell you you're a piece of shit. So it's...
Right. Yeah, I remember a friend of mine in college touched on something similar about New York doing the same thing. And I had never been to either of those cities at that time in my life. And I asked him about it. I was like, so what do you think that is? And he said, oh dude, it's because people don't have time to be full of shit. Like they have to be honest. Like they have to like cut to the chase because you have a very, very small window in which to get the shit out, and that's it, you know? So which I thought was brilliant. I actually am with you. Like, I feel like in some ways, even though I've, you know, lived in Northern California my entire life, and I do consider myself to be a pretty California person, like when it comes down to it. But I also do kind of feel like I tend to be a little bit more blunt and a little bit more like, all right, like I can be long-winded, but at the same time, like I'd rather not be if I don't have to be, you know? So,
but no, yeah, I prefer it.
Yeah. I think that's really cool that you brought all that up, but, you know, so You touched on this a little bit. So you are a teacher. And so you've been now a teacher now for how long?
10 years.
Okay. And I mean, is that something that you wanted to do like for a long time? Was that something that you kind of knew that you wanted to do?
Yeah. You know, I really invested a lot of time in music. I don't think I ever, this also goes back to something I said earlier. I don't think I ever thought it was going to be a career thing for me. But I worked it out in a way, you know, with my job and moving to Chicago. You know, if you want something, you can always like, I don't want to get into this, but I feel the same way about surfing. I've rearranged my life to accommodate it. And I certainly did that with music, but I knew it wasn't going to be like a lifelong, this is your job deal. I realized that very early on. And so I always, you know, later on in the Ghost, we'd split up and do, we split up the year, we do a semester of touring or, you know, 4 or 5 months touring off and on. And then we would allow time for band members, specifically Paul and I, who was the guitar player at that point, to, you know, knock out school credits. Cause I dropped out of college my first year to tour and play. And so, you know, I, at that point, I just, my love of literature, my love of lyrics, you know, I decided to major in English. My mom was a teacher. It runs in her family. I really, certain teachers in high school changed my life. Only a couple. Most of them are dog shit, but it's, you know, you remember the really good ones and the really bad ones. A lot of them I just forgot. And so, you know, having grown up around a teacher, and my mom later went into administration and then developing different curriculums in Richmond, California to accommodate the population there. And yeah, I just, I knew that I wanted to do it. I think, you know, that with lyrics, I always, and this is going to sound corny as fuck, but it's truth. And I always wanted to use lyrics as a way of both communicating pain that I felt or issues that I was encountering in the world, but even more so making other people feel like they were a part of something, and that others out there identified with them, or other people were having the kind of same thoughts, questions, so forth and so on. And, you know, moving away from aggressively touring, I think teaching is a much more hands-on and direct way of helping young people out, and specifically young people that are struggling, whether that's academically or personally. And I don't know if I should say this, but sometimes I'm more interested in helping students that are struggling personally, or helping them find their place in the world or discover more about themselves in the world, than I am with, I don't know, say fucking grammar. But it's, you know, yeah. So it's something I wanted to do for a while.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd like to just go on record and say that I think it's incredibly punk rock of you to do that, because we need good teachers, and I'm sure you're an excellent one. And so you teach high school?
Yeah, I'm teaching high school on the Central Coast right now. My wife and kid and I moved in July in the middle of all this pandemonium, which has been weird. And I'm teaching strictly on Zoom. I guess I'm going back into the classroom in a few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
so shit. Yeah,
I hope. Yeah.
Well, shit.
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit before we started the podcast, and yeah, it's, I know that it's going to be a daunting, but
you know, I'm just trying to get that vax. I'm like all OD on it. It's like,
seriously, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I certainly hope that they're able to accommodate you soon.
Thank you.
But yeah, man, you know, so I want to move on to the last couple questions that I have. You know, I tend to throw these out to everyone. So I appreciate you taking some time to kind of dig into this. But, you know, I like to give everyone opportunity to, first of all, you know, give some shout outs to some artists or some, you know, bands that you are aware of that you think other people may not necessarily be aware of, and just kind of let people know who they are, you know, and I'll provide links in the bottom here.
Awesome. Yeah. So, you know, I think, number one, I'm just going to clown myself and say I'm fucking old. So that creates a situation where I'm a little more off the pulse than usual. And then obviously with the past year, this is just my excuses ramble. I haven't been going to a lot of shows or playing with a lot of bands. So it's been more difficult than usual to find new stuff. That being said, or, you know, I can give you some older stuff that I think is worth listening to. You know, Matt from Great Apes, he's in this new punk band called Whole Hog that I think is really, really fun. I'm trying to think what else. I mean, I think what you're doing with Decent Criminal and Middle-Aged Queers is great, but I'm sure that most people that are privy to your podcast are privy to those bands. Chew has been a punk band from Chicago that I've been into the past couple years. It's like, it's acronymed out, pretty heavy stuff. I really liked that Chubby and the Gang record this year, but I feel like that one, got a lot of hype as is. A student of mine introduced me to, it's really just one guy, but this, Los Retros project out of Ventura, and they're on Stone's Throw, which is, what's that guy's name? The Peanut Butter Wolf. It's like his label. There was a documentary about that label.
Right.
But it's really cool. It's really, really relaxed. Older stuff. Knots, like K-N-O-T-S. That was this like proto-punk band that may have only released one or two singles that I discovered years ago that, like, I don't know, no one I've ever met has been familiar with them, but just super catchy, like proto-punk, power pop stuff. As an East Bay person, I always, like, if we're talking Lookout Records, I always try to hype up Uranium 9 Volt because they were one of the rare bands in that time that was doing more of like an East Coast or DC thing, you know, amidst an angry ocean of pop punk. So, and I still listen to Uranium 9 Volt. That shit holds up for sure. Meatwave over the past, I don't know, five or more years out of Chicago has been kind of a standout for me.
Yeah, I recently got turned on to them actually from Kendra Sheets.
And, yeah, yeah.
And I was blown away. I was like, oh shit, how did I not know about this band?
Yeah, they're great. Really kind of like mixed bag of sounds in there. You know, there's some pretty accessible punk stuff coming in, but also really angular at other times. Great band. I think they really kind of encapsulate the Chicago sound in a modern way. So yeah, I don't know. I could go on, but there's a few for you.
No, that's a great list.
Rob from Great Apes and Josh Koontz, who played in Great Apes for a while, and Ole Holy have it's like acoustic-ish, maybe some electric guitars thing going on that I haven't heard it yet. I know they recorded with Jack too recently. I'm really psyched to hear that. Yeah.
Sweet. Yeah, that's a great list. Okay, great. And then like the last question that I'd like to throw out to everyone, and I'm very interested to hear what you have to say about this, is if you had only five records to listen to on a desert island, like say for the rest of your life, what would they be?
All right. I'm going to go, I'll go Studio One Soul, like Studio One, you know, the reggae comps. That one is like all reggae covers of just classic soul songs because it's a tropical island and we got to keep those fucking Irie vibes going for sure. Yeah. The Baby Huey story. It's just one of my favorite soul records. That guy's, I'd say, a little bit understated. I think people that are into soul or, you know, a lot of record collectors are very familiar, but in a general sense, that would be one to check out as well. So that kind of plays into both categories. No Knife, Fire in the City of Automatons. That one, it was a game changer for me. The guitar playing, just what they do in the bass on that record is just so interesting, yet still punk and catchy. What else? What is that? Three, four?
Three.
That's three. Bizarre Ride to the Far Side. Okay. It's one of my favorite hip hop records. Timeless. And I'm gonna go classic and say Op Ivy Energy. I wanted to put a Fugazi record in there, but Op Ivy Energy, man, that's, you know, that was one of the ones that got me going in the first place. And I, also timeless. I listened to it on the regular and my love of it has remained. It's yeah, if not now, like more than ever. I don't know. So right. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you're not old enough to have really caught them live, right?
No, but interestingly, and I just did another podcast and mentioned this, but so the three of my friends, three young women at the time, I believe I met them in eighth grade or maybe it was freshman year. They're responsible for getting me into punk rock. They were so fucking cool, like reading Ray Gun magazine, dyeing their hair with Manic Panic. And two of them had brothers in bands. One was Jesse Michaels and the other was, I believe it was the singer of the One-Owner Riders. The two of them had brothers in Lookout bands. And yeah, it was Op Ivy had certainly, this is like mid to late 90s, was certainly not a thing anymore, but they were kind of like, hey, this is like, you know, my brother does this shit and here are all these other tapes. Here's your fucking Ray Gun magazine. Welcome to the club. And then to go back, Andy, the inclusive element just faded after that.
Yeah. That's funny. Do you remember what your first punk rock show was?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you what my first Gilman show was. Okay. And that was actually, I went with one of the three young women I mentioned, Meg, to go see the Winona Riders, and the Quincy Punks played too. And the Quincy Punks, that was like my first kind of like, you know, I growing up, you know, not El Cerrito, Berkeley and Albany. It's like, yeah, I saw fucking street punks on Telegraph, but like being in Gilman and seeing the Quincy punks, like, oh, these guys are fucking horrifying. And then the Winona Ryder singer, I just remember him. He's just so goofy. He's like this lanky guy. And I specifically remember he's wearing like a Looney Tunes Daffy Duck t-shirt and just spitting all over motherfuckers. And I was just like, this is cool and kind of fucking scary, but I'm into it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what my first show at Gilman was. I mean, you know, my first punk shows were up in the Sierra Nevadas. I know that my first punk show was AFI. It was at the Sonora Fairgrounds. It was AFI with the Belligerents. I think the Struggle Buggies played, and I think there was like another local band that played. But yeah, I can't remember what my first Gilman show was, but I remember being like kind of concerned because like, I wasn't sure what I was getting myself into because I'd heard all the stories, you know, blah, 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 you know? And I went in, of course, it was like no big deal. Like once I got there, it was fine. But yeah, it like kind of opened up that whole new world. But
it's like an 80s PSA. You go in looking like a preppy kid in a sweater vest and you come out a junkie, like totally
smoking cigarettes and everything.
I remember seeing Black Fork in high school and that one scared the shit out of me. It's like, but yeah, and fuck, RIP Borderline Warehouse. At least you had that up there, you know?
No, we were really fortunate to have had that for the time that we had, because prior to them, we had this one guy who was doing some shows named Mike, and he's the one who got like AFI and he got Screw 32 up there. He got like Let's Go Bowling and a few other bands. But then, yeah, when Mark and Tracy got up there and they opened up Borderline, that just opened up the whole scene to everything. I mean,
yeah.
We had everyone. We had you guys. We had like Link 80. We had, he was bringing bigger bands in like Voodoo Glow Skulls, The Vandals, and Less Than Jake. He had, you know, Mike Park's band, you know, Bruce Lee band up there once, which was like pretty epic.
And kids, again, to go back to the appreciative factor, like I'm sure that people up there just appreciated that immensely because there weren't other options. You know, it's not the Bay Area. It's,
yeah, the closest we had was Sacramento or possibly Modesto, you know. And, you know, Sacramento at the time, I didn't know anything of that town at that time because no one went to Sacramento. But no, hey, Brian, it's been such a pleasure like catching up with you, man. I'm glad you're doing good. And, you know, I know that, you know, it's been kind of a crazy year. And, you know, with everything that you've got with the teaching, I certainly hope that they, you know, find a way to take care of you guys. And, you know, congratulations on being a father and for moving and all those great things. And congratulations on the new album, Black Snow, comes out on AF Records. It should be out in like mid-March, right?
Yeah, at least the pre-orders. I don't know, maybe the actual vinyl around them, but yeah, sometime, you know, early springish.
Got it. But we've got at least one single out and probably another one dropping pretty soon.
Yep.
Right. And yep. There's all of your other projects as well. Like most of them, I believe, are up on streaming. I know some of them may or may not be, but, you know, Great Apes, Ole Ole, there's other Hanalei stuff up there. So check all that stuff out. And, yeah, we'll talk to you real soon.
Andy, thanks so much for having me. Good seeing you, bud.
You got it.